give up the idea that I'm going to convince somebody to change their mind. Let that go. Be curious and then get my view in. But the thing mostly I've learned, if I connect, if I'm willing to listen, I'm looking for some common ground. Usually there's some common ground about some higher values. Then when I share my view, mostly they don't just dump on it.
Welcome to LoveLink, your guide to love and relationships in all forms. We're your hosts, Simone Humphrey and Sina Simon. This is the second time we welcome Dr. Bill Doherty on LoveLink. Dr. Doherty is a family therapist and professor in the Department of Family Social Science at the University of Minnesota. He is the co-founder of the Doherty Relationship Institute, helping couples on the brink and using his model of discernment counseling to work through ambivalence around breaking up or staying together. In our last interview, we discussed dating, breakups, and how to choose a partner. Today, we're thrilled to interview him about his latest project, Braver Angels, an initiative to bring conservatives and liberals together to combat political polarization. Using all of his skills from couples therapy, Dr. Doherty has successfully helped individuals and groups with different political backgrounds come together and respect one another.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Bill. We loved talking to you last time at the Psychotherapy Network. A few years ago, we talked about romantic relationships, but you've been working on something different in recent years, focusing on the world of politics. And we were wondering how you became interested in using your skills as a couples and family therapist to help conservatives and liberals to understand each other better.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to be here. It's interesting, romantic relationships to political relationships, interesting bookends here. Mm-hmm. So I got into this just by happenstance. A couple weeks after the 2016 presidential election, do you happen to remember that one? That
minor, oh, yeah.
Earthquake. I was sitting at this very desk, and a colleague, a long-term colleague of mine who we worked in family fatherhood things for a long time, David Blankenhorn from New York City, called me and said that he had been on the phone with another colleague of ours, David Lapp, who lived in Southwest Ohio, South Lebanon, Ohio, and they were talking about how people in the Upper East Side of Manhattan and Southwest Ohio were feeling about the election. You could just imagine, gloom and doom, the world is ending in Manhattan, and hope and change, morning in America, in South Lebanon, Ohio. And they decided on the spur of the moment to invite 10 Hillary Clinton voters and 10 Donald Trump voters from Ohio to participate in a workshop, a 13-hour gathering over a weekend in early December, a few weeks out of 2016, and to see if they could talk to each other and not just about each other. I said, oh, that's really brave. What were you thinking of doing with them? And David said, well, they didn't know, but they thought maybe I could figure that out. Because I worked a lot with groups and I'm a therapist. And I had this this hope that I was going to be booked. So I got my schedule book out, and hoping that December 8th to the 10th, love to have helped guys, but no, but I happened to be free. And I said, sure, what the heck? And so that's how it started, with a very powerful experience of people in this small town. Coming to understand each other, humanize each other instead of demonizing each other, if I had to say it in a phrase, understanding each other better. They when we asked them why they came, they said, we have a community to run here. We've got schools to operate and hospitals and roads to build. We just can't keep fighting each other and make this work. So it was a really powerful experience. And I thought it would be a one-off, a great story. a great story. Back in 2016, I did this thing. But they didn't want to stop, and we didn't want to stop, and flew back for a reunion, and we just decided to keep going. And now, you know, 5.5 years later, I've been 2,000 workshops, and this is all over the country. Wow. And so Braver Angels came out of that experience, and that's how I got into it. By no big strategic plan, just by happenstance, and I just used everything I knew to design that workshop and others. Everything I knew from my couples therapy experience, from my small group process experience, everything I ever knew put into this.
Amazing.
I'm so curious just to hear a little bit about the process you went through in preparing for that first workshop. Because it sounds like, wow, that's such a daunting task. You're you know, this polarized political moment, and you're going to Ohio.
And not to mention your own political beliefs, which I imagine you were carrying with you and coming in as a somewhat biased psychologist. I remember as a therapist sort of having all my own feelings and responses and wondering how I was going to approach patients who had a difference in political beliefs than
I did. Well, good points, Simone, because prior to the election, I had authored a therapist manifesto against Trumpism and got 3,000 plus signatures of therapists from around the country, some of whom were very prominent therapists, a manifesto saying that Trumpism is a mental health challenge to our country and it's a threat to our democracy, and that therapy only works in a democracy. Mm-hmm. So I did media interviews, kind of representing psychotherapists. So I was in the as strong into the anti-Trump camp as you can get within the profession of therapy. And when he won, I realized this invitation came. I realized that the world of the anti-Trump and Trumpism world would be well staffed. But the world of healing the divide between people who voted for him and voted for Hillary, that red blue, that was much more fragile, and that my skills lined up with that, because red blue is like a couple, right? So I shifted. I deliberately shifted out of resistance to repair, and that's the world I'm in now.
So I definitely want to know more about this repair process and how you help people come together and have conversations, but maybe we can kind of pull back a little bit and kind of get a sense of how you understand why America is so polarized, how it's gotten worse. I mean, you think even since 2016, and why people demonize each other of different camps.
Yeah, so a political polarization, according to the political scientists and historians, has been rising for about 35 years. Mm. There's always some, of course, but it really took off about 35 years ago and has been increasing ever since. And a key here is that we're not talking mainly about polarization on issues. So it's not that we have socialists and extreme right-wingers in terms of just policy. A lot of Americans are sort of policy-wise sort of in the middle. But it's what political scientists call affective or social polarization, sectarianism. How we feel about people, the people who think and vote differently from us, rather than mostly about issues. Because there's always been issues, division and polarization. I mean, our country was founded on a huge debate about the size and scope and role of the federal government. This is Hamilton and Jefferson. And that divide, liberal-conservative divide, has been with us forever. And it's an important debate to have. But what's happened increasingly in the last 35 years, and spiking now, is that people who differ from me are the other, that is, I don't understand them. They're incomprehensible to me. How many times have any of us said, How could those people possibly believe blah, 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 okay? And of course, they're doing the same thing. How could they possibly believe? So the first is this sort of othering. They're incomprehensible. The second is that they are unlikable and untrustworthy as people. So I don't understand them. I don't like them. They're hypocrites. And then the third is that they are morally compromised. Okay. They're looking for power. If you take the abortion debate, for instance, they happy to kill babies. And on the other side, they give not a rip about women's autonomy and women's bodies. Not a rip. Okay. And by the way, those three categories, unlikable and untrustworthy and morally compromised, they come from a important article by a psychologist named Eli Finkel and a bunch of other social scientists published in the journal Science in the year 2020, where they pulled together a lot of that literature and they compressed the three core elements of polarization into those three. And they are about not how we feel about a political leader, you know, Trump, Pelosi, Biden, whatever, but how we feel about the 70 plus million people who voted differently and who will vote differently each time. How do I feel about them? How do I feel about family members, extended family members who are on the other political side? So that's the way that I characterize what this polarization is, and it's really toxic.
And what is it about our human nature that makes us, just from, I don't know, from an evolutionary standpoint, that makes us feel so threatened by this other group who we don't, you know, we don't trust them, we assume a lot of malicious intent. It really strikes me, both within myself, but also in what I see in other people, how much emotion gets stirred up by the group that's different from us.
Well, as you said, this no doubt goes back to our evolutionary origins, you know, that our communities were probably 100 to 150 people, and the other tribes, the other communities were perhaps scary and threatening. And so we kind of evolved to have an other out there who you didn't just walk up to a complete stranger from another tribe, another community without, you know, if you did that too freely, you maybe got killed and you didn't pass your genes on to the next generation. So there is something in human nature about this. However, there are social factors and political factors that call this forth or diminish it. Okay, so you have countries like Yugoslavia who held together for a lot of years, and then communism left, and then you had the Croats and the Serbs and everybody fighting each other. The calling forth of old rivalries, old othering, that had been diminished. So in the U.S., what the political scientists suggest is a whole bunch of factors that have converged in the last 30, 35 years to exacerbate something that's always there in potential. So your point is that there's always the potential. You just choose volleyball sides randomly, and you can get people at each other's throats. You know, mm-hmm. So this is in us. But when the social system contains it, redirects it, then we're in better shape. But what's happened in the last 30 plus years is that we've had a rise in political identity being more salient than other forms of identity. So when I was growing up, religious identity was huge where I grew up, you know, Irish Catholic. And an intermarriage was marrying a Protestant or a Jew or you know, heaven forbid, something worse than that. Whereas now, starting about 35 years ago, marrying across political parties is more threatening. So politics has gotten in our identity partly as a function, they think, of decline in civic participation, in social trust. So we've had these big declines in how much we regard the world around us as trustworthy, how much we regard institutions as trustworthy and reliable. So we have this atomization, this of people, leaving. People don't join the PTA in the way they used to, the League of Women Voters, a big decline in social participation, at the same time as political identity becomes more salient, okay? So you don't have as many cross-cutting identities, okay? You're not the treasurer of the PTA with somebody, you're a Democrat, that person happens to be a Republican. You're not doing that. You're more in a profession, maybe even in a company, in a religious oriented group that is more sorted, S-O-R-T-E-D. We've sorted by red and blue, neighborhoods, towns, professions. We talk about the world of therapy. It's an almost entirely blue profession. Mm-hmm. Okay, and the reds or conservatives sort of hang out. They hold back. So your friendships based on this. So we've sorted ourselves, and we have this rise in this globalization that has left a lot of people behind. There's been elites who have benefited from this, and a lot of people have lost livelihoods, the manufacturing sector, and they feel left behind. And feel resentful of the elites who are making it. The elites who are for large-scale immigration, where non-elite people feel like their jobs are threatened. Whether or not that's accurate or not is another story, but people feel it. Whenever you have mass immigration in a country, and we've had more immigration in the last 20-25 years than we've had in over a century, in any country that is mass immigration, you have social unrest. Everywhere. And this is happening in Scandinavia. It's happening everywhere. It's just hard on a country. And I'm not saying it's not worth it, but it creates social unrest. It creates inside outsiders. And then you can have political leaders take advantage of that. Mm-hmm. Social media. Social media is an accelerant of conflict between groups, an accelerant of it. And so you have the rapid spread of the worst accusations against people of the other party. When I was young, you the only way you spread this stuff is you had to do mimeograph machines and run off your nasty stuff about somebody. You had to have envelopes and lick the envelopes and put a stamp on it, and you paid your money, you send it out. And now you can just send out a meme that just spreads around the world. And so lots of other factors we could talk about. The last one I'll mention is the media outlets. You choose your media outlet according to your political views. So you get information that is consistent with your political views, and you don't get information that's inconsistent with it. And so we lack shared facts.
Yeah.
We lack shared information upon which to make decisions, because our sources through social media and other media, our sources of information put us in different informational worlds. So that's just a few reasons, simple reasons.
I mean, as you're going through it, I'm like, oh, it really makes sense why people are living in so much fear and how easily we become polarized. It's a perfect storm of stuff.
It's everything kind of compounds against the other. And so, yeah, you have a kind of culture of untrustworthiness, and then you have social media, you have these news outlets, you have a president who's very polarizing. Everything just sort of builds on top of one another.
Yeah, so when you talk about president, this has been rising through multiple administrations. Okay, so it starts back in the Clinton years, and it's happening around the world. I mean, think about Brexit. In Great Britain, for example. So this is happening. It's happening in Scandinavia. Look at the Swedish elections. So we have a phenomenon that is not that an individual politician like Trump can be a further exacerbator, and actually comes out of that. In other words, it's hard to know how much he contributes versus he's an effect of it. but also an accelerant. And so when I talk about this in community settings, where I ask people to reflect on the sources of polarization, I always say, stay away from assigning the main responsibility to any particular political party, any particular politician, because it's going to cross administrations and it's happening in countries where that don't have Republicans and Democrats. So these are larger forces that are making us strangers to each other.
So you set out such a nice framework, I think, for understanding why there's this political divide, why there's this polarization. So walk us through a workshop and tell us how you help people have these conversations when, I mean, like, as you mentioned, different news sources can almost bring such different kind of, it's like you're speaking two different languages to one another. So what happens in these workshops?
So a big thing is you avoid starting with policies that people have different information about. You go deeper than that. And that's why it's like therapy. People have, like, a couple has content issues they come in with, and you just don't stay at the level of, well, let me help you negotiate your chores, okay? You know, no, what's behind that? What's behind your differences here? So we have a number of workshops. Our signature workshop is we call the red-blue workshop. So we say red, it means you lean conservative, you tend to vote more for Republicans than Democrats. Blue is you lean liberal, and you tend to vote more for Democrats than Republicans. And so you have eight and eight for a workshop, and these can be either 3 hour or all day. It begins with a statement of goals about why we're here, to understand each other across differences, to get beyond stereotypes of each other, to find common ground if it's present, and to learn something that could be helpful to our communities and our country. Those are the goals. And then we have people introduce themselves, their name, where they live, and in 1 minute or less, why they chose to come to this workshop. And of course, they've read about what it's about, but it starts off, again, this is like therapy in a sense of, tell me why you're here. Tell me what you want to get out of this. And so people do that introduction. We have them seated round tables, red, blue. Okay, so you're always sitting next to people who are different from you politically. And there's little red or blue placards in front of them, and their name tags are in red or blue. And for the most part, people express their worries about the country and about the divisions, and as they're showing up in their families, in their communities, and they're there to try to learn something that can help with the division. So usually they're coming for the right reasons. Then we do ground rules, some of the ground rules are you're speaking for yourself, not for another organization. A big one is that we're here to listen and to explain ourselves, not to convince anyone to change their mind. Okay, that's actually the first ground rule. And we get to the clinical stuff later, but that's a huge part of the clinical thing, that people in a family and a couple set out to change somebody's mind in something very basic to them, and it's a failure right from the start.
It never works.
We get their agreement to follow the process that's laid out, sticking to the agenda as it's presented and the exercises, and we ask permission for the moderator to intervene gently when people veer off. And so we then hold people to what with the process that's to follow. We don't let chaos break out and people. So the first exercise is a stereotypes exercise. And that is that people in Reds and Blues go to separate rooms. They come up with the top five negative, false, exaggerated stereotypes that they think the other side has of their side. Mm-hmm. If I'm with the Reds, what do you think Blues think of Reds? That is stereotype, that's false, exaggerated, negative. And they brainstorm that, and then they vote on their top five. And then each group is doing it. And then they do two things with their list. I should tell you what comes up on the list most frequently. The Reds believe that the stereotypes held of them by the other side, racist, that's always first, racist, uncompassionate to people who are needy, anti-woman, anti-science, Bible thumpers, okay, uneducated. Blues come up with arrogant and elitist, into big government for its own sake, unpatriotic, anti-religious, unconcerned with free speech, unless it's politically correct, snowflakes, hypersensitive snowflakes. Okay, so we just urge people, and we say frame it in baby killers. Mm. Okay, we just urge people to put it out there, say it bluntly, okay? And then each side has a separate facilitator, moderator, and they go through two steps. One is, for each of those stereotypes, if you think it's wrong or exaggerated, correct it. What's true instead? So if they think you're racist, then articulate what you do believe about human equality and dignity. So to that. And then the second question is there a kernel of truth in the stereotype? Mm. And this is a key to this workshop, because we're looking for humility and we're evoking that. This is how we describe what a kernel of truth would be. It could be true of a subset of your group. It could be true historically, and it's carried over. It could be a blind spot, something your group doesn't pay that much attention to. And it could be, the fourth one would be, in the heated rhetoric of public debate, your group can come across this way. Mm. Okay? And so each group is coming up with its stereotypes, corrections, and kernels of truth. And then the moderator nominates somebody from each group who seems to get it, and who particularly gets the kernels of truth. And we come back together, and somebody from each group presents their stuff to the other side. And as people are listening, they're to be thinking of this two-part question. What did you learn about how the other side sees themselves, and did you see anything in common? Hmm. So what did you learn about people see themselves, and did you see anything in common? And so they present, and then red blues get in pairs to process that two-part question, and then we go around the table sharing.
And what do you hear from them with those questions about what you learned about how the group sees themselves and what you have in common?
Yeah, people see the other side as more nuanced, as more... particularly when, the stereotype of not caring about poor people and people in need, to say we do, and we emphasize less government policies and so on than private sector and individuals, and they may mention the fact this is actually true, that conservatives actually give more money to charity than liberals do. And that they're concerned about the side effects of government policies. But the kernel of truth is that they often are not paying enough attention to the effects of poverty, and sometimes with an unrealistic belief that all the ships will rise if the economy goes well. For blues, often they cop to the arrogant and elitist, a bunch of know-it-alls. And how the unpatriotic, how they can get into being critical of the country but never say anything positive about the country. But they'll affirm, we do love this country, and we don't say that enough because we emphasize the negatives. We say that the negatives are part of loving the country, but we don't say enough what we see as positive. Anyway, so what happens is people do go, this other group are more complicated than the stereotypes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so that's a powerful exercise. Yeah. And we start out not with some, easy thing like, boom, it gets out. This is why I put it in. This gets out on the table the worst stuff that people say about each other, but in the safety of saying this is, each group articulates it differently.
They already have all of these assumptions that the other people are thinking of, and that's what kind of contributes to the demonizing. And I love I love that it both is self-reflective, like how do we contribute to this perception, but also cultivates compassion for the other group for seeing maybe some of them in these stereotypes.
Yeah.
So it's lovely.
That's right. When they land the stereotypes, and this is part of the training of the moderators, to hold people to that. Because the stereotype, the kernel of truth, that's what I meant to say, the kernel of truth has to make you wince. Mm. It's something you regret. Mm. So, for example, a red group I led once said, not all reds are racist by any means, but most racists are reds. Mm. And this is troubling to us. What is it about our side that is attracting these people? It's very troubling.
Mm-hmm. I imagine there's such a softening that can happen in each of the groups when they feel that sense that each group is acknowledging, taking accountability for those kernels of truth, you know, that they're not totally crazy. There is something there, you know, and they're owning it.
Right, exactly. And so, for instance, another moment was when the Blues said about the stereotype about big government for its own sake, the correction of the stereotype is we believe in social responsibility. We think some problems really can only be addressed by government, and this is part of creating equal opportunity. And then I still remember one group saying, but we are better, and this is the kernel of truth, at putting new programs into place than we are about evaluating and seeing if they're still working and removing ones that are not working. Mm-hmm. And so once things get in there, they go on forever. Mm-hmm. And so when somebody says that, the red is going, this person makes sense.
Right.
Okay. They're not occupying a different world than I am. So that's the first exercise.
It kind of also shows that people are much less extreme than the perception that actually, I mean, I don't know if this is also part of it, but that people are more alike than they think. We want to fight poverty. Right. We want to help people get back on their feet, better the economy, have more jobs, like all of this stuff that people share, it's just framed in such different ways or implemented in such different ways.
Well, implemented. So that's the big thing I've learned from, you know, doing these workshops is that at the level of aspirations and core values, there is much less discrepancy than at the level of policy. Mm-hmm. Most people want all of our children to be well-educated, everyone to have access to quality health care. How we get there, we differ a lot. So what happens is in these workshops, we get them, we don't start with it until we have universal health care, okay? You know, government-sponsored health care. People, you know, can talk about what their values are. So let me go to the second exercise, which is a fishbowl exercise. And this is a classic small group dynamics thing that I, you know, learned many, many years ago, when you have two different groups. One group, you flip a coin, one group is has chairs in the middle of the circle. By the way, we learned it, all of these online too, on Zoom, okay? Because you can have people on the screen and everybody's off the screen. But talking about it face-to-face, so you have your eight reds, let's say, in the group with the moderator, and the Blues are sitting in an outer circle, observing, listening, and learning, but not participating in any way, verbally or non-verbally. So it gives you a chance to listen to a group who are different from you, talk among themselves, not arguing among themselves, talking among themselves, with you listening and not exchanging, not preparing your response. And so the two questions we ask is, the first one is, why are your side's values and policies good for the country? Why are your side's values and policies good for the country? And the second is, what are your reservations or concerns about your own side? Your reservations or concerns about your own side. And so the first one gives people a chance to say why conservatism helps our country, that it allows individuals to flourish and to take opportunities and to have a stress on liberty, a stress on allowing the kind of creativity that capitalism can unleash, where people can run with ideas and create jobs for other people. So they'll talk about those things. And then what are your reservations or concerns is the humility question. Okay. And I remember a guy who gave the most beautiful articulation of how conservative principles, policies can alleviate policy, poverty, excuse me, poverty. And here's what he said, and he's accurate about this, that new forms of capitalist enterprise have lifted more people across the world out of absolute poverty than any government aid system ever possibly did. And this has happened in Africa and other places where the microeconomy comes in. You know, cell phones have allowed people where there's no infrastructure to communicate and create small businesses and, you know, small business loans. And so he's absolutely accurate about that. You free up people's ability to innovate. And then in the in the reservations of concerns, he said, A reservation I have is that people on my side often don't pay enough attention to the people who are left behind in that process, that not all the boats rise. And we often lose our values and our compassion and our messaging when we say, well, it'll just sort of happen. And we don't do enough for the people who fall behind. And so you're a blue listening to this. And you get this idealism, and in your mind you're thinking, well, it's more complicated than that. And then he nails the complication. Mm-hmm. And then blues will talk about acceptance of diversity, of the freedom to have different kinds of ways of being sexually and gender and lifestyle, compassion for the poor, creating opportunities for everyone, leveling playing field, the importance of government being proactive. But then they will say things like, we stifle people's speech if they don't use the words we like. And we put people down, we moralize these things, you know, that we believe in, and we communicate to people that they're evil. If they, and this is terrible when we do this kind of thing. And the Reds are going, well, thank you for that, okay, in their minds. And then the same process, pairs, red-blue pairs, and then around the whole group. What did you learn about how people on the other side see themselves, and did you see anything in common? Mm-hmm. So can you see, you know, I can go on, there's more exercises than the rest of it, like it's a question and answer exercise and other things, but those are the two kind of core ones. And they, when people nail those, and they usually do, I mean, it's really powerful. Mm-hmm.
And when you, I mean, it sounds very, very powerful. And I wonder, how do you prevent people from getting too much into content? Because it seems like there's this delicate balance of, yes, you're talking about, let's say, how conservatives or liberals, how their policies are good for the country. But you don't want to get into too much into the facts or the details, because then you could just be having a discussion about that and not really getting at the core around values. Right. And so I wonder, as a facilitator, how do you manage those situations?
That's what the training is. That's what the training is, and we train the moderators to people veer off to bring them back, and they've given us permission to do that. And so it's you say, so I hear you on that, Sina, and you have a lot to say on the specifics of healthcare. Right now, I want to go back to the question about the general question about how your side's values and policies are good for the country. I'd like to hear from somebody else who hasn't spoken yet. Yeah. Okay, it's group facilitation process, but the structure holds it. Now, I'll give you one other part of the ground rule for the fishbowl. You speak only about your own side. You do not do comparisons with the other side. You do not mention the other side. So one of the things that both groups often talk about, reservation concern, is money and politics. Okay, a lot of regular people do not like all this money out there, supporting politicians. Nope, they don't like it. And what we say in the instruction is then, you know, don't say, well, both parties do this. Talk about your own. Only your side. Only your side. Can you see this as something, a big part of my couple's therapy, is don't speak for the inner psyche of your spouse or partner.
Yeah.
Speak for yours. You could, you know, stay on your side of the boundary. So we enforce the boundaries, and so it's all part of the training.
Hi, LoveLink listeners. Our group practice, Modern Mind, is located in New York City with offices in Brooklyn and Manhattan, offering in-person and virtual psychotherapy. We provide individual, couples, and group therapy, as well as ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, in conjunction with a psychiatry prescriber. Therapy is a powerful experience that can transform your life and help you live it to its full potential. We're here to help take you where you want to go. To find out more about our practice, visit www.modernmind.co or email info@modernmind.co to be connected with one of our therapists.
So this is a very highly structured workshop. I wish everyone in America and maybe the world could take this because I think it would just help with perspective and understanding and compassion and connection. How do you, it sounds like a lot of people want to take this workshop because they have family with different beliefs, different political identities. How can they bring with them? How can we learn from these workshops and take that into the wild?
Yeah, well, we have a whole series of other workshops in which we teach the skills of how to communicate across difference. The Red Blue is an experiential workshop, but we have a workshop called Skills for Bridging the Divide. We have one on families and politics. We have one on depolarizing within, how to depolarize within yourself, and how to intervene with like-minded people when the conversation veers into demonizing the other side.
Well, interesting.
Great. Okay.
We have a specialized workshop on being red in a blue environment and being blue in a red environment. So we've got lots of other ones that where we teach people and then they get to practice the skills. One of the things I want to say, by the way, is that we've attracted academics to this now, and we now have research evidence based on a randomized controlled trial that the Red-Blue workshop does work. It does depolarize people, and that the effect continues over time. So it's nice to know.
You're doing important work. Like, this is really what the country needs right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. And it's expanding because our new initiative is what we call Braver Politics. And so we're now interacting with local political elected officials, county, state legislatures, a little less there at the moment, and with members of Congress. Part of what's happened is we've learned that elected officials are not happy campers these days. They are dealing with toxic environments where their bosses control everything. So we're getting increasing invitations from elected officials at different levels, like school boards. So this is the space we're entering now. And I'd like to tell you about a question that when we do experiential workshops with elected officials, the core question that we begin with is not the stereotypes one, because that's too risky for them. It's too risky for them to say, well, people see our side and here's the kernel of truth, because that could be used against them. The one we begin with elected officials is this question: what life experiences have influenced your values and beliefs about public policy and public service? Life experiences that have influenced your values and beliefs about public policy and public service. They know the question's coming. They get a few minutes to just prepare and take some notes. And then everybody gets 5 uninterrupted minutes to tell their story. Every time I've done this, there are tears. There are tears. There is vulnerability. There is a beloved grandparent who supported them. There was growing up in poverty. There was the death of a spouse where somebody decided to get. There's family of Holocaust survivors. And I want to tell you a story that just represents, for me, this a lot of what we do. In New Hampshire, state legislature, 8 reds, 8 blues. Some of them pretty polarized folks. That's what I found out afterwards. but the Speaker of the House invited them to do this, and they're all leaders. When I walked into the room, the reds were sitting on one side of the room without masks. The blues were sitting on the other side of the room, all masked, like two teams here. We got them into smaller groups, and we asked that question, life experiences. And I'll never forget this moment. There was in my small group, there was a blue, a Democrat, sitting on my left, who talked about growing up in the foster care system. His father had left the family. His mother was paranoid schizophrenic. He was in and out of foster homes. And this gave him a passion to try to make a difference in his life and eventually in the legislature, so that, you know, government could do things to help prevent this and to deal with these kids and the families. He finished, and on my right, a Republican said, "Oh my God, I don't believe this. I grew up in the foster care system."
Wow.
And then he told some of his family story, and his, and he had this passion. His approach was more the private sector, the voluntary sector, the church sector. He got involved in labor unions, getting, you know, kids job training and so on. He's skeptical about government solutions, but they had the same root system, the same experience. So, and I'll end with a quote. When I did this with some members of Congress, a guy who said, he said, when he introduced himself, "I'm as conservative as the day is long." And he told his story. He heard the other stories, and there were tears in the room. And then he said, when we asked people, "What did you take from this experience?" He said, "You can't fight somebody in the same way when you know their heart."
Mm, yeah, it's so powerful, it's so when beautiful. You make it personal.
Doesn't this sound like what we do in therapy?
Totally. And bringing in history, a person's personal story, that's always so meaningful, rather than staying.
And brings the humanity back in. You know, it's really hard to hate someone that you know on this sentimental, intimate level.
Right. Yeah, who you share tears with. Right. Powerful.
Yeah.
So if we switch gears a little bit, I wonder what kind of advice you would have, kind of back to Simone's question about what to do when we're out in the wild again, you know, like not in this formal setting of the workshop, but, you know, we encounter people of differing political beliefs all the time. Right. And I find it difficult when I encounter somebody who is very conservative. I find myself, if we start going down into the world of politics at all or touching on social issues, like this sort of inner rage start to come up in me. Like I don't want to go there because I'm afraid I'm going to get angry at this person. And I so yeah, I wonder about what kind of advice you would have in those moments. And I'm sure that same energy has been directed at me too, right? Like, I guess it's depolarizing yourself to be able to open yourself up to having a conversation. And also, when to not have the conversation?
Yes. Yeah, so I'm now remembering way back, doing a workshop in Maryland where there were about a dozen therapists in the room, and it was a skills workshop. We taught listening skills, expressive skills, and so on. And I asked people at the end what they were taking with them, and a therapist said, "You know, I know all these skills, but I never thought to apply them to political conversations." So that's part of my response, that what we know is that curiosity is more important than telling people what they should believe. And so listening to what's below the policy, listening to the value, listening to the fear or the concern. So suppose you're to take something that's in the news these days about college student loan forgiveness. And you're dealing, and let's say you think it's a good idea, blah, 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 and you're a blue, and a red says, "I think people should be responsible for their own decisions. I didn't go to college, but I worked my way, and I didn't get any big relief." Knowing the skills we know as therapists, if you choose to engage, you're probably, your best thing to do is to reflect that back. "So I can see that really bothers you. It seems unfair. And why would people make a decision and then they don't have to deal with the consequences of it? And you yourself, you know, didn't have that advantage." Okay. And so the principle here is connect first and then share your perspective. Connect first, then share your perspective. That's the heart of all of our skills. Instead of saying, "You say up, I say down, you say left, I say right, you say hot, I say cold," that's how political conversations go. So you connect first, and then you find something to agree with, if at all possible. Okay, so I might say, and I'm with you on, we don't want to encourage people to be irresponsible in their decision-making about spending in life. We don't want the government bailing everybody out for, you know, you shouldn't have bought that house, but well, the government will bail you out, okay? So, and then the person's going, yes, yes. I mean, that now they see me as a reasonable person because I have paraphrased their view and I've agreed with something.
Yeah.
And then there's a kind of a skill I think I've created a name for it you can use if you want. I call pivot. A pivot skill would be something like, can I share my perspective on that?
Mm.
Okay. If you get an opening, then you might say with I messages and without characterizing their perspective, staying on your own side of the boundary, you might say, in general, I think I agree with you that the government shouldn't be removing people's debt. I think the college thing is a special case. And then I might give my reasons for it. Okay. And then I might end with saying, but I understand not everybody sees it that way. And I accept that people could disagree about this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You see what I've done?
Absolutely. On the connecting part, what are some ways that you can ask about their values or their personal experiences? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's wonderful if they give that up just naturally, yeah. but how do you ask sort of what's happening underneath? What sort of question?
Yeah, so another maxim of this work is that when there's a passionate political opinion on something, there's usually a story under it.
Important to remember.
So if you have connected first around, I hear you on this. I hear this is a big deal to you. And they feel you're listening. You could, again, without any sense that you're going to do a gotcha, you could ask, this sounds like it's really important to you. And I'm guessing there's a reason that, I don't know if something in your life or, you know, I really would be interested to hear what the background is for you. So I have a relative, for example, who's passionate about against affirmative action. Passionate. I've listened enough that he said something about, you know, he saw in his work, blah, blah, blah. So I'm really curious about what happened in your work that led you to this. So he gave me a little clue that I followed up. It turns out he was in law enforcement, and he felt that there were some people, unqualified African-Americans, put in to the, this was a federal government law enforcement thing, that he didn't think were going to be able to defend him if things got really bad, that they weren't skilled enough, and that he could lose his life.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Now, whether that's accurate or not, I don't know.
But it's about his safety. It's about him.
It's about his safety.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that it was safety that added something to the general, this isn't fair, we shouldn't put people ahead of line. There was something there. But can you see, and this is the other thing I'll say, and I deal with couples around this all the time, is to give up the idea that I'm going to convince somebody to change their mind.
I think that's huge.
That let that go. Yeah. Okay? And to be curious and then get my view in. But the thing mostly I've learned, if I connect, if I'm willing to listen, I'm looking for some common ground. Usually there's some common ground about some higher values. Then when I share my view, mostly they don't just dump on it. Now, if they were to, so senior, going back to what you said, if somebody's just there to lecture me, then we teach skills for how to exit the conversation.
What do you say in that situation?
Well, a whole range of things, such as, well, this looks like something we don't, we're not going to see eye to eye on. Okay. If somebody kept at it, I'd say, you know, if we stay in this, I'm afraid it's going to hurt our relationship. And you're more important to me than this difference. And I just don't want to. And then the final one, I teach this in Minnesota, the way you get out of messy conversations. So how do you think the how do you think the Vikings are going to do this year? You know, or just sort of change Total the pivot. Topic. And the last one is just say, I got to go. Just yeah. get out of here. So we actually teach, and this isn't done enough in communication skill training. In all of our workshops, we teach people how to handle difficult moments and get out. How to protect yourself in a conversation. Because if you can't protect yourself, ultimately, it's too risky to get in.
I'm also really curious how you make sure that Braver Angels appeals to both conservatives and liberals, because I could imagine, you know, from what you were saying in the beginning, that it could easily be perceived as, you know, kind of blue therapeutic organization.
Elitism.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Run by sure, academics.
Sure.
You're one
right.
of them,
Sure. Well, it is a challenge, but let me just back up and say a key early decision we made was that the leadership at every level was going to be half red, half blue. So the board is half red, half blue. I'm on a leadership group of 14 is half red, half blue. We have state chapters. The leadership is half red, half blue. So we make a big effort there. Having said that, blues are more attracted to these kinds of workshops than reds, which means you have to more actively recruit reds. Okay. And so because reaching out across diversity is more in the blue wheelhouse. If we were doing workshops on patriotism, that would be more in the red wheelhouse. So that's just reality. And we do have tensions within Braver Angels because we have a membership of about 11,000, and it's about more than 2-to-1 blue to red. And so reds can feel like there's a blue tinge to it. And the thing is, you know, as a blue, I know how obnoxious conservatives can be, but I'm much more aware of how obnoxious liberals can be than I was before.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It like correcting speech.
Mm.
So you're in this. Now, when people have been through a workshop and they join a local alliance, we call them, they do more policy-oriented conversations there. I mean, in other words, they've been through this. They've learned some skills. And so you'll have a red who, they're talking about immigration and then uses the term illegal alien, which was the term of use for a long time, but it's no longer in. And so a blue will correct them. This does not help.
Yeah.
This does not help. And then they get shut down.
Right.
So there's internal stuff we have to continually deal with. And we try to walk the talk about how we deal with our internal differences.
So what's next for Braver Angels? I mean, it sounds like you're taking the country by storm. What do you guys have in store?
Yeah, right. Well, the Braver Politics one is just a year old and taking off. So I've been doing red blues, a modified red blue with a member of Congress locally who invites his constituents, red and blue, to come together, and they pick the topic, and then we do a Braver Angels approach. So we've done 7 of those. And we have it down now. And so he's interested in spreading those around the country so that you have a member of Congress meeting with a more intimate group. And by the way, the member of the Congress becomes part of the group and they share their personal stories and other kinds of things. And then with this is Representative Dean Phillips, who is a Democrat, a centrist Democrat. We're going to reinvent the congressional town hall because they have stopped doing them because they've gotten so contentious. And the town halls at every level, like local town halls, Supreme Court, or school board meetings, they're what I call 19th century designs. You have a member of Congress or somebody gets up, they go on for a little while, and then people get up one by one, and then they, nowadays, they have a microphone they didn't have in the 19th century. And they give speeches, they do criticism, they get techie and wonky, and they're boring. Or they're not boring at all, and they're contentious. It's a primitive design. So take school boards. People have the open mic, they go up to the mic, they say stuff, and the school board members are not able to say anything except thank you. Next. There's no exchange. There's nothing that communicates to people that they've been heard. Mm. Anyway, without getting into the details, that we're going to try to reinvent the Congressional Town Hall with modern features, small groups, large groups, report outs, all that kind of thing. And then I'll stop at one big one that we're launching now is on trustworthy elections. So we've done a piloting of a workshop called a Common Ground Workshop, in which people who are divided on a particular topic come together and they go through a set of exercises in which they listen to each other's values and concerns and why they hold their policy beliefs. And then in separate groups, having listened to the other side, you come up with values, concerns, and solutions that your side agrees on. And that was, we've done this with abortion, pro-life, pro-choice. We did it with elections in a pilot. Having listened to the other side and pre-read, so, you know, there's some other input, what do I think we believe that they could also believe? And then you present it to the other side, and anybody can veto anything. It has to be unanimous. At the end of the day, unanimous agreement. The abortion group came up with 20 things they agreed on. Better birth control access, sex education in the schools, maternal child health programming. Can you see why blues and reds would both want better, pro-life reds would want better maternal education? You don't want your kid to starve?
No.
Okay. And so 20 solutions. The around the trustworthy elections, they had like 12 or 13 solutions they agreed on in general. So we're going to do that trustworthy elections thing all over the country. And this is something now I'm going to describe we've never done before, because the elections or the workshops are one-offs and people could join an alliance. But there's going to be people nominated, a red and a blue, from each of the individual workshops to form a larger group who are going to craft a statement to the nation of consensus agreements about how do we ensure confidence in our elections going forward. So grassroots up, common statement based on all that's been done, and then we'll look for massive attention to that. So that's a new one. And then I keep saying that's the last, but there's more. because businesses and companies are coming to us now because they're dealing with this. And so we've developed a work in politics workshop that a major company is going to pilot with them. So there's lots of folks coming to us on this now.
Such important work. Yeah, it's really cool.
And I want therapists out there to hear, to be listening for this is just not therapy put out there, but to listen for the therapeutic stuff, particularly from couples therapy that's involved here. That we know that in couples therapy, it doesn't really take off until each person can own their contributions.
Yeah.
Okay. So can you hear that in the red blue? Mm-hmm. Creating boundaries where you speak for yourself, you don't speak for the other person, you don't characterize the other person's behavior. You talk about what you got on your side of it. The process of couples therapy, in which you have to have a container that's safe enough that you don't let people hijack. Mm. You don't let them interrupt each other. You don't let them escalate in front of you. And you elicit humility, if you will. You elicit things that in a less safe environment don't come out. You elicit vulnerability.
And you get them to be a team. And that sounds like a lot of, you know, the work that you're doing now is to get conservatives and liberals to be a team on certain aspects, right?
That's right. And saying that we're a polarized country then externalizes the problem, just as with a couple, that there are large forces that are leading us to hate each other. Mm-hmm. One of my most inspiring things that anybody ever told me about, he went to a couple workshops. This is a guy I know locally. The most polarized blue I have ever met. this guy would rant about conservatives. And he owned apartment buildings, rentals. And he told me that if he sensed that somebody was a red, he would not rent to them.
Wow.
He said reds are not a protected class. And so he would just discriminate against them. Okay. And he took a couple
of
workshops.
Which is the very thing he probably hates in a lot of reds.
Of course. Well, that's the thing. There's an old phrase, choose your enemies carefully for you will become like them.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So he told me, we learned sometimes you have to take more than one workshop, different kind of workshop, to get multiple doses of this, you know, not just one. But he told me with tears in his eyes, and I get teary even telling the story. He said that he that week was talking to a woman in a work setting, and he deals with a lot of people in construction and other areas who are reds, okay, and repair people. And he said, the woman said something kind of senior like, oh, you know, I don't agree with that at all, is what he was saying inside. And he said, you know, I don't agree with you, and I respect your right to say that. And then he said, I've been taking these Braver Angels things, and here's what I've concluded, that powerful people want us to hate each other. Let's not do it. Isn't that something?
Yeah. Let's take a stance together. It was a way to kind of align.
Let's take a stance together.
Yeah.
Just like a couple. You can align against your problems.
Yeah. Yeah.
Instead of letting them come between you.
I think that's a beautiful takeaway. And maybe a good place to end on, to kind of remember this humanity, the kind of stronger alliances than we think. And I love this idea of sort of thinking about it more along communication, like the couple's work, rather than getting so attached to the content that we feel like we have to defend our morality and our values, which I think then becomes so big and loaded that it does feel like, you know, you're fighting for justice rather than hearing someone who's like you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's a losing battle.
A losing battle. If they get a sense that you are not they are not acceptable to you with their beliefs, the closer they are to you, like family, the more they'll fight you.
Yeah.
But I also want to say before we finish that you can passionately believe in what you believe in. This is not being wimpy. And you are more influential when you connect and listen to people and express curiosity. Because then when you say with iMessages, this is something from my life story, from my values, that is really important to me, you're more likely to have somebody hear you and perhaps in some small way be influenced than if you do the self-righteous, I'm going to tell you how the world is, you idiot.
So important, because then they're in a protective stance. And you lose them.
Right.
Well, thank you so much for joining us and for this conversation, this very important conversation. We hope to talk to you again. It's very exciting.
Hey, well, this has been, you can tell how much fun I've had.
Oh, yeah. I think we should do a round two at some point and check in with Braver Angels, see what you guys do in a few years.
Yeah. What we could also do something in the future just about the clinical aspects of this political divide, because I've been doing workshops on politically divided family members and how do you help them maintain a relationship in the face of this, of the different tribes that they belong to.
Absolutely. Yeah, that would be great. It would be really helpful. Yeah. All right, Bill.
Okay.
Well, thanks so much.
Great pleasure.
Thanks so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed the episode. To stay in touch with us, sign up for our quarterly newsletter at lovelink.co, where we share our favorite articles and resources about love, sex, and relationships. Also, in future episodes, we plan on answering listener questions. So if you'd like your questions featured on our show, send us a voice memo using the Anchor app or send it directly to our email, info@lovelink.co. And if you have a second, truly, the best way you can help support us is to rate and review the show in Apple Podcasts. Just scroll to the bottom of the Lovelink show page and let us know what you think.
We thank you all again so much for listening. We're truly touched you take the time out of your busy schedule for us. Until next time.